Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote for your exact needs, helping you get money off your annual insurance for your bike, scooter or mopeds and much, much more.
Don't forget to please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get to your podcast from so that you never miss an episode, or you can watch the whole show on YouTube right now for those of you who like pictures as well as sound.
Right, it's another week and you know what that means, another fantastic guest. And today we've got an absolute belter. For me growing up, he was Mr. Motorbikes. Yeah, a radio presenter, a motoring journalist, and probably most known, well, in my eyes anyway, for being an absolute god on the original Top Gear, their motorbike expert, the one and only Steve Berry. Morning, Steve.
Morning, Ewan. I've taken a liking to you already, lad, because it says North immediately above your head in big letters. So sorry, David, but immediately my prejudices have surfaced on the bloke who's got North in massive letters. I won't move the camera because it'll probably end up on the floor, and but behind me is a river view of Henley-on-Thames, which is about as not in the north as a place can possibly be, isn't it?
That's very posh, Steve. Come on.
Well, I am posh.
Well, I feel a fraud then, because I'm actually right down south, but obviously this is an old advertisement for some tyres from up north, and Mr. Pratton there actually is up north, so he's your northerner, I'm the southerner. But anyway, I'll take all of your love. All of your love, Steve.
Well, is he? Come on, Dave, where actually are you? I'm in Salford, mate. It don't get more northern than that.
Well, I'm just north of Harrogate, originally from Hull. So that connection of two, I mean, I think equidistantly across the country, we're probably at the same point, just about, I think, geographically.
Yeah, but the north is not a geographical location. It's a state of mind, isn't it? Do you know, like New York.
I love the fact we've got existential within the first couple of questions. We're not even a couple of questions in the first chat. This is where Full Chat takes you, Steve. Absolutely everywhere.
Well, do you know the beauty is? North, southerner, northerner, wherever we are, we've all got the mutual love for motorbikes, and that's why we're here chatting. And I've got to start, Steve, by asking you, for me, the original Top Gear, whether it's original or the latest series, whatever it is, in my eyes, that has to have been the dream job. What was it?
Not really.
Oh.
When I got the gig, I sort of had my dream job already. Shall I tell you how I got it?
Yes, please.
Chance, I was working as the editor of Street Fighters magazine, which was the sort of early 90s version of custom bike magazines. Me and my younger mates had noticed that there was a trend for people to modify four-cylinder Japanese sports bikes that had either been crashed or were unloved, stuck at the back of the garage, rip off all the plastics, stick flat bars on them, put bigger flat slide carbs on them, mental exhausts, turbos, whatever. Mm-hmm. And as we found out when we took these motorcycles to Bruntingthorpe and speed tested them, make them slower than the standard bike. I tell you what, the number of bikes that we tested on Street Fighters that did absolutely titanic numbers on dynos, but then when they actually were sent through a speed trap, was slower than the standard bike, was ridiculous. But they look good. They look good going slower than the standard bike, you know what I mean? And I was doing that, and I used to, because I was the only one in the office, which was in Hale. You'll know that place, David, because that back in the day, that's where all the top players lived, Hale and Hale Barnes near Manchester. Yeah. That was where Fergie and Rooney and Bex and Nevilles and all them lot lived. Mm-hmm. It was also the home, bizarrely, of Britain's third largest motorcycling publishing company, Myatt McFarlane, who had about a dozen titles. Classic Bike Guide, Backstreet Heroes, Scootering. We might come to that in a minute. I was the editor of Scootering at one point. And Street Fighters, which was kind of, you know, and I went to the boss who sort of graduated from being a biker to having an Aston Martin and having tweed suits made for him and stuff like that and going shooting like a lot of people do. And said, hey, listen, there's this new craze, this new trend, whatever, calling them Street Fighters. And he was clever enough to see that even though he hadn't got a clue because he kind of moved on, that it was the next big thing. And it was for a while, and I did that for a few years. But I was the only one who came into the office from the north, from Bury, Bury, Lancashire, Steve Bury from Bury. Everyone else came from the south. And so it was my job to get a pint of milk in the morning for our brews. And I used to go in the newsagents, and which was run by two elderly twin ladies who did that thing where they had the same haircut and wore the same clothes. So you never knew which one it was. So I'd go in and I'd go, hello, what's a lovely, and avoid sort of names and everything, because I thought, you're just doing that to mess with people. I nearly said something else then. But anyway, this, I used to talk to people that went in there, and there was this bloke who went in. So I used to talk to when I went in. I was always on a different bike, because that was the great thing. I also was the assistant editor of Which Bike magazine, which only came out once a year, but was a list of all the bikes you could buy in the UK. And because it had been a big deal back in the day, Which Bike, it wasn't by then, by the sort of late 80s, early 90s, it wasn't, but it had been a big deal back then, because it was part of Which, like a consumer group. And I could still ring up Honda and Yamaha and BMW, anyone, and say, oh, it's the Which Bike here. Oh, Which Bike, right, okay. Yeah, can I have a blah-de-blah? And they go, yeah, we'll send one round. They used to do that back in the day. Send it round in a van. It was great. Mm-hmm. So I'd always be on a different bike. And this bloke who I talked to in the newsagents, Dennis, one day he said to me, oh, what's that? And I said, oh, it's Yamaha or whatever it was. He said, oh. He said, you do know who I am, don't you? And I said, yeah, you're Dennis. Nice guy. You live locally. You've got an old man BMW. Remember, BMW only built old man bikes, like with massive screens and like great big plastic boxes on the side. And the only people that actually bought, well, the only people who really rode one all the time were the cops. If you got pulled over back in the day, they were always on a bloody BMW and they made old man bikes. Yeah. Well, he had an old man one with a massive screen on it and all that business. And he said, I'm the producer of Top Gear. And I went, oh, very good, wonderful. And just went out the shop. It was like that.
Yeah.
I think he thought, how dare he not be all over me and begging me for an audition and this, that, and the other. But I was 25 and I was the editor of a monthly motorbike magazine, and I could ring up virtually any manufacturer and get them to send round whatever bike I wanted to ride. How cool is that? I couldn't be bothered. Top Gear, to me, back then, I thought, Top Gear, isn't that that bloke with a beard stood next to a Montego going on about its safety rating? Because people forget it was a really sort of dull consumer show for many, many years before it became cool again.
So I mean, Steve, saying that then, with you then becoming part of it, was there something in the back of your head as not necessarily an agent of chaos, but bringing a bit of personality to what it was and your particular part in it?
Well, the funny thing about being on the show was that my mates couldn't work it out, because I was a fiend, like, back in the day. I remember coming on once on an innocent day, just, like, rocking up at our house on my Harry Holdsworth 10-speed, and my dad saying, been a police sergeant round to our house this afternoon. I want you to go and see him. And he said, if you don't go and see him, he'll come and see you. And I thought, uh-oh.
No way.
Uh-oh. All my chickens are coming home to roost. Yeah. They weren't very happy.
So you mentioned your dad there. There's so many people we speak to on the podcast, and me included, who say, you know, how did you get into bikes? And it's normally the dad. It was my dad who showed me how to ride a bike or tinker with a bike. Was it your old man who got you into the two wheels?
Yeah, of course it was. Everyone's dad had a bike then. Everyone. My dad, my mother, my mum and dad, they're like a Bruce Springsteen song, because she was privately educated and from a posh background, and my dad was trouble. My mum told me, she said, your father was in a band. He played stand-up bass in a skiffle group, and he had a triumph and a jet black quiff. He did. He was a handsome man, my dad. You might not have earned, honestly, no, seriously, you might not have heard of this actor, but there was an actor called Montgomery Clift. Do you remember him? He was in films with James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, that sort of thing. Well, my dad doubled for him in a movie. How about that? Back in the day.
No way.
He was a handsome dude. Oh, and the mother said, yeah, your dad used to sit outside the Palais de Danse in Bury, cleaning his fingernails with a flick knife. And I said, did he not go in? And my mother said, no, he was banned for fighting. And I thought, Oh, what a surprise. And then, of course, when we were being brought up, my dad was like the responsibility figure. But I'd meet people and they'd go, oh, your dad back in the day. And I'd be really, oh, yeah. He could pull a wheelie on a Triumph Bonneville. And I see kids doing it now. And I think,
on a Bonneville?
I think, yeah, an original Bonneville. And he said he used to pull wheelies through the centre of Berwick on a Triumph Bonneville. God. And I'm thinking, that's not easy. I mean,
when I see lads
doing it now, I think, if you want to really impress me, go back and do that on a Vincent or a Triumph Bonneville and not crash, and then I'll be impressed.
So would he have a bike then that you were allowed to go on, allowed to tinker with, take out for a little bit, kind of under the radar? Was that how you got into it?
You're joking. So nowadays, of course, they call it a side hustle, don't they, when somebody's got this extra thing going on. Well, back in the day, every working class man in Britain had a side hustle. They had something that they did to earn a bit of extra money. My dad worked in a paper mill. Bury's a paper town, or it was a paper town. Famously, people would say, oh, yeah, Bury, Lancashire, home of the black pudding. The team that won the FA Cup by the biggest score. And the other thing they'd say is, oh, you can read a newspaper at midnight in Bury because the light from the paper mills is so bright. And it was. It was. I mean, I know I sound 1,000 years old, but it was back in the day when I was growing up. And what my dad used to do was he used to buy and sell old cars and motorbikes, do them up a bit, bodge them up a bit and sell them on to make a bit. He had four kids, you know, and he worked in a paper mill, so he'd do that. So he'd buy and sell old BSA single cylinders, C15s, old Honda 90s, stuff like that. And then one day, I'm in the bedroom, and I'm 10. Don't know what I was doing. I was 10, so it probably was quite innocent. If I was 11, probably not. But anyway, so I heard this sound. I heard this distinctive sound at the window in our Coronation Street-style two-bed terraced house on a cobbled street. Ran to the window, and I didn't put the two things together. I saw the superbike of the moment, a Yamaha RD400, and I heard the distinctive sound of a two-stroke, and I thought, look at that! And it was, best of all, it was yellow, Kenny Roberts yellow, with the black and white speed blocks.
Cool.
And I thought,
very cool.
Look at that! What's that man doing outside my house? And then it took me a while to realise it was my father sat on it. I mean, it was clearly him. He was wearing my dad's donkey jacket and my dad's old helmet, but it just didn't compute. It was completely out of context. He'd gone to work that day on a Honda 90 with a big fishing box on the back. Do you know where fellas used to do that? They used to put a massive box with all the fishing gear on the back of a Honda 90. They'd pull good wheelies.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's dad.
I mean, that is an iconic image. Suddenly seeing the old man in his kind of retrospective glory, thinking, who is that cool dude down there? Even though he's wearing a donkey jacket, you're going, that's my old man there. So, I mean, a psychotherapist, Steve, would have an absolute whale of a time with this, because there's your formative experience. There's what set the tone for the rest of your life, isn't it?
Yeah. So what was worse for him was when I then got into scooters. And the thing was, everyone who was cool at our school was into Madness, The Jam, Two Tone, scooters,
mods and rockers, isn't it? Yeah.
And the lads in the greasy denims, they were like the dope brigade. I was like, I don't want to be with the girls. The girls didn't fancy that. With the flares, come on, mate. I was there on my Vespa, Two Tone tonic trousers, green flight jacket, and get this, I was at a party in Palm Springs at the Parker in Palm Springs. Do you know it? It's like this super cool hotel.
Palm Springs, lovely, yeah, very nice.
Cadillac just used it for an advert for their amazing new car I know it's not a car thing, but I like cars as well. Don't like cars. I love bikes, but I like cars. Anyway, I'm at this party, and this bloke says to me, the Afro comb with a spirit level was invented by my dad because he had to cut your hair. That was his opening gambit to me. And I was like, what? You know, talking about out of context. And he said, you used to go and have your hair cut. I'll tell you what, Dave, it wasn't far off your hair cut now. It was a flat top. You know, like Suggs from Madness had it. Really short at the sides and then on the top, but flat.
Yeah.
And he said, you used to go to my dad's hairdressers in Manchester and get your hair cut. You used to be obsessive about it. And so was he. And he, in the end, he got a, and he said, you used to turn up on your scooter and you'd go in and you, he'd spend ages doing it, way longer than on anybody else. And in the end, yeah. he strapped a spirit level to the afro comb so that we could get it perfectly flat. And then you can still buy an afro comb with a spirit level in it.
With a spirit level.
And he said, he always said to me, I used to spend forever doing it. And then he used to go outside, flip the seat up on his scooter, put his helmet on, squish it all down on his helmet. And I was like, oh no.
I was just going to ask that. All that time spent sculpting it and constructing it, jamming your helmet on and taking off.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. It's where you go, isn't it, with things? Because people said to me, I can't believe you used to be into scooters. And I say, right, well, I'll tell you a story. I was at a BBC shindig, like a cheese. You two have probably been to these things, loads of them. One of those cheese and wine things where you've got to be nice to everybody. Where they warn you beforehand. They say, don't get hammered.
Yeah, yeah. Don't be yourself. Yeah,
don't be nice. So I went, right, okay, no worries. So I went there and I ended up sat next to Des Lynam, right? Now, you particularly, Dave, probably be interested in this.
Glorious Des Lynam, yeah.
The first thing I said to him was, shouldn't you be at work? Do you remember when the World Cup was in Japan? I remember we were all in our
and it was that was during the day, wasn't
work.
It?
And he went, should you be at work? Yeah. I said, that was genius.
Yeah.
But he said to me, listen, don't really like football. I said, you what? This is after we've had a few drinks. He said, I'm not. He said, I like football. It's all right. He said, but my real loves are tennis and boxing. And I said, oh, right.
Really?
Yes. And he said, but you take the gig that's available, don't you? And I thought, yeah. So I ended up, I loved motorbikes and then switched to scooters because that seemed to be the thing to do. And I sort of got stuck a bit. It was like, oh God, I'm stuck doing this. So it was fortunate that the bloke who I worked for, so, you know, I was there on a Friday night and I'd been doing the scooter thing, scooter magazine for a couple of years, been to Italy, numerous times, and sort of it had run its course, and I was thinking, I've got to get a change here. And the guy who owned the company came downstairs and said, do you like Harley Davidsons? And I went, yeah. And he went, good, because you're the new editor of the Harley Davidson magazine. I've sold the scooter magazine. And on the Monday, so on the Friday, I was thinking, I don't like being the editor of the scooter magazine anymore. On a Monday morning at 9 a.m., I was riding away from Harley Davidson UK on the first Harley Fat Boy in the country.
Oh my word.
I went, your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle. I was riding over and I thought, this is awesome. This is absolutely.
That is amazing.
Even though those early Fat Boys, they're so heavy, they're so underpowered, they look great, didn't they? With the solid wool.
Yeah, yeah. And they shake it to your teeth as well, don't they, Steve? Yeah. Those earlier ones.
Man alive. You
vibrating away.
Steve, do you think to a certain degree you've made your own luck in life? Because I think you're such an outgoing personality. You said like the Top Gear job, you weren't really interested, you still got it. This magazine with a Harley came about. It sounds to me like you're definitely a glass half full kind of guy. Is that how you live your life? Positive?
Yeah, man. Because I done a real job, like up here. Like when I left school, I went in the building game. That's what my dad did. After all the mills closed, see, here was the thing. I see other people in the media and think, yeah, you're like me, like Stuart McCorney, Mark Ratcliffe, them two, similar age to me, both grammar school boys like me, both lined up, one's from Wigan, one's from Bolton, I'm from Bury, Sean Keaveney, they're from Lee. I've met these guys, I think, yeah, a fellow traveller. We were being lined up. See, Bury is the smallest metropolitan borough in Britain, but it had at one point three state grammar schools. Why? Well, because you needed people to run the paper industry. In Bolton, you needed people for the textile industry. In Wigan, in Huddersfield, in all those towns across the north and the Midlands, you needed lads to run industry. And that's what we were being prepared for. When I was going to be doing O-levels, they said to me, I wanted to do arts, subjects and language. And they were like, no, you've got to do technical drawing, physics. It was like, oh, yeah, we're just all being shuffled into the paper industry, which was the industry that all our dads worked in. There were umpteen mills in Bury. East Lancs, Transparent, Wiggins Tea, Bibby's, Barron's, Wilds, the umpteen. Mm. When I actually left school at 18, there were two. There are now zero. So what are we supposed to do? You've got all these lads. I had like 8 O-levels, 4 A-levels. What am I supposed to do with them? Well, I'll tell you what I'm supposed to do with them. Go and work on a building site as a labourer, which is the job that I ended up doing. And I did that for nearly 3 years. And I remember I was on a building, I was on a site in middle of winter in Harper Hay, which is home to the world famous Embassy Club, previously owned by Bernard Manning. And Harper Hay is one of the rougher parts of the rough parts of Manchester. And I'll tell you what we were doing. We were trying to dig a drainage channel with pickaxes, but it was a tough winter and the ground was so hard, it wouldn't take the pick. The pick was just bouncing off the ground. It was that hard. And we rang the boss from a payphone. I'm 18, it's 40 years ago. Rang the boss from a payphone and he said, right, I'm coming. And he came in this big 4-ton ex-army truck. And in the back, he had 2 braziers. And he said,
yeah,
well, like these, they'll heat up the ground and then you'll be able to dig it out. And I thought, I mean, one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich, we did that at O-level, where he was in a gulag in Siberia. I'm heating the ground so that I'm stood next to a brazier with a pickaxe waiting for the ground to thaw out. I am not doing this for the rest of my life. So I went to university, first person in our family to do that. I mean, I saw something today where some kids were saying, oh, yeah, then we all go to university. I thought, what do you mean you all go to university? Why does everybody want to go to university? I went to university because I wanted to be a journalist, a writer. And that's what I became because I went to do English. And I just think a lot, you two were probably too busy with sport for university. I don't know. But it just seems to me that a lot of kids now think, oh, I've got to go to university. And you think, well, what are you going to do? You're going to spend 4 years saddling yourself with a ton of debt. Why not just go and get a job? Mm. A lot of people, some people, so yes, but not everyone. It seems like everyone these days. Anyway, that's what I did.
Mm. So, Steve, from that point of view, then, I mean, that is some jump from heating the ground to smash it up with a pickaxe to being stood in a studio with Alexa Clarkson, Tiffany Dell and Quentin Wilson on a BBC show. I mean, I presume, I mean, given what I've learned from you in the 20 minutes that we've been chatting, there is absolutely no way that jump would have escaped you. You'd have been stood there knowing where you've been and where you would be then, wouldn't you?
Well, here's the thing. Before I was on Top Gear, I'd done a couple of movies as a stuntman.
Stuntman?
Yeah. My daughter, dream. My eldest daughter, Alex.
Of course you had.
Was with Boss Agencies in Manchester. Nigel Martin Smith, the guy who created Take That. My daughter, my eldest daughter, exceptionally beautiful child and a beautiful young woman now, she was with Boss and she did some big prop. She was in the Esso collection catalogue. She was the child in that. And she did adverts for Sony and Britax safety seats. And she got auditions for movies. And I took her for an audition. There was a movie called Letter to Brezhnev, and it was the movie that about two Russian sailors, and it was Alfred Molina was in it, obviously went on to be big star in Hollywood. He was Dr. Octopus in the movies and stuff like that. Anyway, he was in it. But this was the director's next movie, and I took Alex for an audition, and I went home, and the former Mrs. Berry said, did she get the part? And I said, no, but I did. Because Chris, the director, forgot. And I was in a leather jacket, and Chris said, can you ride a motorbike? And I went, can I ride a motorbike, pal? I was the editor of a motorbike magazine. I went, can I ride a motorbike? Yeah. And he went, do you want to be in this film? I went, go on, then. So when I got to Top Gear, I was like, where is everyone? Because I got used to catering, makeup, wardrobe, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Got to Top Gear, there was a girl with a clipboard, a cameraman, a sound recordist, a director. I was like, where is everyone? And they went, what do you mean, where is everyone? I said, makeup, wardrobe. They all started laughing because I sort of got used to it. I got an equity card, believe it or not, because I did 2 movies and they gave me a speaking part.
That's amazing.
They gave me a speaking part in the second one. I got 3 lines and I had to say, my 3 lines, I'll tell you my 3 lines in this movie. They were, are you doing business, love? How much? And my request is most unusual. And in the next scene, you saw a man being berated with his toupee. I remember when it was premiering. It premiered at the Edinburgh Film Festival, and my mother said, "When's this film that you're in, Stephen? When's it coming out?" And I said, "Mum," she said, "I want to tell the girls at church cleaning." And I thought, "Oh dear, I got angry with this one." And I said, "I don't think it's the sort of film for you and the girls, Mother." Because as I've told you, my mother's quite posh, like privately educated and that. And she said, "Oh, Stephen, it's not a dirty film, is it?" And I said, "No, Mum, it's artistic." And she went, "Oh, well, that's all right then, if it's artistic," and carried on the dusty route. And it was, you know, it was actually, it was 30 years ago, but it was about trans people and cross-dressing and all that sort of stuff. And in one of the scenes, I had to double for the two main actors were Danny Cunningham, who was Sean Ryder in 24 Hour Party People, and he was in Soldier Soldier.
Yes.
And Kenneth Cranham, who's a brilliant actor. I watched him in something the other. He's, you know, he's had a brilliant career. He played the father. And I had to double for, was it Ken or Danny? I had to double for him and ride this 750 Kawasaki in, get this, full-face black crash on, mate. Black leather jacket, you like this, a 2-2, and 21 old Doc Martin. And I thought, I'll be absolutely fine. Nobody's going to find out. I'm wearing a full face helmet. So we do this shoot in Liverpool. I wear the 2-2, I wear the 21 old Doc Martins, I ride the motorbike. A couple of days later, I go in the Horse and Jockey and bury the biker's pub. And there's a bloke sat at the other end of the bar who's known to me as Badger. And he looks exactly as you two would picture him. A biker. Beard, long hair, denim jacket, cut off, loads of patches on it, rides a sort of chopper type bike. Good guy, Badger. So I go in, there's only us two in. I order a pint and he takes a sip of his Guinness and he went, "Not wearing the 2-2 today, Steve." And I thought, "You what?" And he said, "My missus is the props buyer on that film that you're doing." And I thought, you can't get away with anything. There's 400 million people in there, Manchester. You can't get away with anything. But like, you know, like
small world. Saying,
when I got to Top Gear, I wasn't fazed by it. I just thought, why are there so few people working on this project? Because I'd got used to it. I say I was of a couple, but when you've done a couple, that's you know, I thought it was going to be like that, loads of people, and it wasn't. It was just a few.
In film, Steve, isn't it? I'm in films. It's meant to be bigger than this. Come on.
Yeah, come on. Well, like I say, I thought I might want to be an actor because I got those three lines, and everyone after I'd done the scene where I had to pick up this member of the oldest profession in a sidecar outfit. Let's not go there. After I've done it, people coming up to me and going, "Oh, brilliant, well done, kissy, kissy. Oh, darling, I'm so happy." And I was like, "What?" And they said, "Oh, well, now you'll get your equity card." And when I've subsequently met, because my missus is in the film business, the current missus, when I've met people, actors, people in the film business, and I've said, "Oh, yeah, I had an equity card. But I gave it up after like just a few weeks," and they said, "What do you mean?" And they can't believe it because some of them have spent years trying to get an equity card, and I just got one like that. But when I went to the Top Gear interview, the boss said to me, "Are you the member of any professional organisations?" I said, "Yeah, National Union of Journalists and Equity." And he went, "Oh, ditch the equity card." And I said, "But keep the NUJ card." He said, "Journalism good, acting bad." He said, "We don't want actors." Well, look what happened when they got actors on Top Gear, eh?
That's incredible.
So, Steve, you said obviously you were very underwhelmed with a lack of personnel on Top Gear, but what bikes excited you when you did get the gig and you said, "Listen, this week you're going to be reviewing this bike or next week it's that bike"? Was there any bike that stands out to you during your time at Top Gear that you thought, "Wow, that was a proper bit of kit"?
The 916 Ducati. I mean, it was just... For me, it's still the ultimate motorcycle. And I've ridden everything.
Thing of beauty, isn't it?
I've ridden, like my upbringing, my taste in bikes is Catholic. And I've ridden everything from a 27cc strap-on little engine that was literally in a biscuit tin that this bloke had designed to be clamped to the front wheel of a bicycle did 52 mile an hour on that. It was terrifying on a bicycle. That to get this, an 8.3 liter Boss Hog. You know those Boss Hoss. You know those things that keep doing this, don't I? Because I'm like bars. Yeah, 8 point, and everything in between, and everything's had something to teach me. Everything. I'll always take the opportunity to ride a crap motorbike because I'm always looking for a benchmark of crapness. So there's the benchmark of brilliance and crapness, and that's how you talk to people and tell them about it. Because if people say it's something good, like I meet journalists who just rode a very particular niche of bike, and they'd be talking about other bikes, and I'd think, you only ever ride sports bikes. You haven't got a clue, Matt. You've got to try everything. And then I'll listen to your opinion because it's coming from a place of knowledge and experience. If you're just telling me what you think because you've read other people's stuff. Like when people come back to people say, oh, yeah, such and such is... I remember I was having a chat about... This is... Sorry to bring car stuff in. But I was in a barn, this bloke who was with a mate of mine started talking to me about cars. And I just made a video for this supercar hire company. So I'd driven the McLaren F1, all the supercars, the Lamborghini Huracan, all the supercars. And this guy was talking about supercars. And I was saying, oh, I found that one a bit clinical, blah, blah, blah. And about 20 minutes into the conversation, I realised he was talking about driving them on Forza. You know, like the video.
Oh, my God.
And I thought,
my God.
I thought you meant in real life. Sorry. But he was straight-faced. Yeah. Oh, well, on the limit, it just felt a bit twitchy. And I'm thinking, in your living room, I was on Snake Pass between, like, you know, Matlock Bath and Manchester. He's driving them. I wasn't in my living room driving them. Yeah, you know. 9160K for me was the standout bike on Top Gear. And also an Eagley Vincent. I went to Switzerland. I went to Fritz Eagley's place in Switzerland and rode an Eagley Vincent, which I think is just, it was just the perfect combination of one of the top three motorcycle engines of all time, the Plumber's Nightmare, the Vincent V-Twin. Yeah. And a much better frame and forks and suspension as devised by Fritz. Mm. Although I did blow up his VMAX the same day, rather spectacularly. Except that's his fault.
Endearing yourself to people across the world.
Mate, that's his fault. I mean, he said to me, oh, there's the VMAX, supercharged VMAX. And he said, I won't do the accent. Because he's Swiss, and nobody knows what a Swiss accent is anyway, because they've got about five languages.
No, very neutral, as ever.
Yeah, yeah. So he said to me, have a ride of this, but can you take it over the border into Germany? Because if you ride it here in Switzerland, I'll get in trouble. He said, it's only a few kilometres to the border. So we went over the border, got it out of the back of the van, and the cameraman, I used to work with this all sorts of people, but, you know, and got on with most of them, to be honest with you. You know, some really great people. But got on with some especially well, including this guy, Keith, this South African cameraman. And he said to me, all right, Steve, go on down there and give it the bennies, like this. So I go up down this road on this VMAX, and I come back. And I'm going to give you two lads a bit of advice now. If ever you feel the urge to sort of go into an area of motorcycle fashion where you're not sure yourself, don't go there, right? So if you ever think, do you know what? I'm going to get some chaps. Now, we all know that's not a good idea, right? And what I'd done, thinking I was going to be riding this big supercharged VMAX, I thought, I'm going to get all Mad Max 2. I'm going to wear fingerless gloves. And I never wore fingerless gloves in my life. And I got some fingerless leather gloves, and I thought, well, I'm like one of Toe Cutters gang, which is probably not a good idea. I go off down the road on this VMAX, and I had a VMAX at the time, so I'm familiar with the motorcycle. I go down the road, I'm thinking, wow, this thing's making power, like it's spinning the back wheel up, everything. I come back, and I pull up, and I say to Keith, who was very dry, the South African cameraman, I said, how's that? Because I thought, I'm giving it loads, and he went, very good, but your trousers are on fire. And I looked down. It looked like my trousers were. There was smoke coming off my trousers. So what did I do? Tried to put it out like this, didn't I? Putting out my trousers. I'm wearing the
slapping your chaps.
Fingerless gloves on. So then my fingers are up, the smoke coming off my fingers. And I'm thinking, what do I do now? And there was a voice in my head that said, a little voice while all this was happening that said, yeah, fingerless gloves, mate. You thought they'd make you look hard, don't you?
Not a good thing.
And look what's
not
happened.
Good thing.
You went there. God. You went there, Barry. And you know you shouldn't have gone there. But look how it's turned out. So just the top tip. When we took it back, there was just a big hole in the side of the engine. And we took it back and they were going, ooh, what do you think he's going to say? I said, well, what you should say is, I'm very sorry I nearly killed you with my exploding motorcycle, because all I'd done is ride it up and down the road. Mm. And he was great. He threw us the keys to his car. He said, oh, I'm really, really sorry. Here, drive my car. It's the most powerful street legal car in Switzerland. And we went outside and there was this Chevy Malibu 1960s muscle car with a massive supercharger sticking out of the bonnet. Anyway, we're not talking about cars, but the rest of that day was a lot of fun. And nothing blew up, which was good. But fingerless gloves, unless you're in a Charles Dickens play, just say no to fingerless gloves.
Don't fit, especially on a bike. All right, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping on the fingerless gloves point. If you haven't already, please press the follow button with fingerless gloves on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Or you can watch the whole show on YouTube, which hopefully if you're doing now, you're finding it as entertaining as you would and I. That's bikes from the past and bikes that you class in your all-time list, Steve. What do you ride currently? What's in the stable?
I ride I'm past that, the stable. Oh, like when you become the proprietor of a motorbike shop that never actually makes any profit. Like when you end up with 9 bikes or 11 bikes or 20 bikes.
In various stages of undress.
That's the problem with motorcycles. You can get a dozen in the same space that you can get a big car. So you end up, you just end up with so many bikes, and then you get pulled over. Oh, no, the MOT's run out on this, and you're like, oh, damn it. And it's because you've got too many bikes. People will be saying, you can't have too many bikes. Yes, you can. Do you know what you need? 3. It's like Goldilocks and the 3 Bears. You need one that's hot, you need one that's cold, and you need one that's just right. And I've got a big adventure bike, I've got an old school cafe racer, and I've got a scooter. And for me, that's enough bikes. Seriously. Otherwise, it's just, my pal's got a big whiteboard in his garage, and it's got all the servicing and all the MOTs and all the tax debt and all that. You're just running a bike shop that doesn't have any customers.
Admin.
You can only ride one bike at a time.
Out of your 3 bikes, and Steve, out of the 3, you obviously love them for different reasons. Your hot one, your cold one, your warm one, whatever you said. What is your one? If you can only take one, my friend, for the rest of your life, which would it be?
Well, if you don't say BMW GS, you're an idiot. If somebody put a gun at your head and said one bike for the rest of your life, and you don't say BMW GS, you're a fool. Because I've ridden those motorcycles, and the current one, the 1300, is not only awesome, but a lot better looking than the last one, which looked like it had been beaten viciously with the ugly stick made from wood from the ugly tree. But was a it now looks much better, rides, and even though I didn't believe it, it's sportier now. The 1300 is sportier. Mm. But the GS was, I mean, you must have so many people who come in here and say that. I mean, and like, if I go out, the guy I've just mentioned, who still has the motorbike shop that has no customers and never makes a profit, he's got multiple motorcycles in there, all sorts of kit. Whenever we go anywhere, turns up on his he's got 2 GSs. He turns up on one of his 2 GSs. The same way that car collectors who have Porsches and Ferraris always turn up places in a Range Rover. Always.
Well, I was going to say, I'm very sad to say this, but that's about it for this week's full chat, powered by Bikeshot, which, of course, is a shame, as we could sit and talk about this all day. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshot will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance, and so much more.
Got to say, I love recording these every week, but a huge thank you to our guest today. I think it's been one of my favourite ones of this series. The brilliant and one and only Mr. Steve Berry. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve. Don't forget to follow us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from so you never miss an episode or you can watch the whole glorious thing right here on YouTube.
Thank you very much for listening. As ever, we can't wait for you to join us next time. Thanks very much.